And welcome to another episode of That's Absurd. Please Elaborate, the show where two science communicators take the most absurd, outlandish, weird, strange questions from you, our listeners, and then we apply our science research slash typing into Google skills, and we try and find the real answer for you. I am one of two of the aforementioned science communicators. My name's Julian Huguet.
I'm Trace Dominguez. I guess I'm the other of the two.
You're two of
the
two.
Science communicator. This is a very long title of that I have to really process
it is.
Here.
Your business card is very unwieldy. It doesn't fit neatly in a wallet.
It goes around onto the back and there's extra space.
You have to
space.
Keep turning it. We're rotating it around. And you join us, listeners, for a very special episode. About 1 year ago today, the very first episode came out. My, how things have changed since then.
Have they?
I think so. Well, first of all, we have listeners now.
Oh, right. Yeah. When we first released an episode, it was mostly my mom, your mom.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my mom still loves it. She puts it up on Facebook every time a new episode.
She sends DMs to the Instagram account. High fives and hearts and stuff. I love it.
I love having a supportive family. So that's nice. But we have more than just our respective parents, and therefore we don't have to be the ones asking each other questions. We get a lot of questions now pretty regularly, which is exciting. And some of them are not quite long enough to turn into their own section of an episode. And so these have been accumulating, and we thought, you know what? With the 1 year anniversary coming up, maybe we do something special. Maybe we do like a lightning round episode.
Yes. We could like burn through a few questions like really fast and get really cool, fun answers. But we kind of came up with a new format. Mm-hmm. So audience, bear with us on this.
Yeah.
Basically, we're going to answer some questions and we're going to do more than two this episode. We're going to do like six.
Here's the thing. As of this moment, Trace and I have no idea what those questions are because we have a very special, I don't know if guest is the word, because you've heard his work, his contributions in every single episode going back to that first one a year ago. It's our fellow producer, our editor of the show, our silent partner who's silent no more. Please welcome Kyle Sisk.
Yay!
Kyle, in the edit, please insert some applause. For yourself.
I will, for sure. Earlier, I was just thinking, I have to decide every week how much of that host bit I leave in.
Yeah, do you ramble on the title?
We do ramble about... Well, basically, yeah, this podcast would be like twice as long if it weren't for you, so thanks.
It's true, and it wouldn't sound as good, and a lot of the sound design, too, there's some moments... I was listening to an older episode the other day and realized we were talking about something, and like this really subtle kind of like cricket, like nature thing was swelling up. It was when we were talking about lawns, and I was like, that was just Kyle contributing sound design on his own, and it really added something, so... Thank you, Kyle, for all you've done for the past year, and welcome finally onto an episode of the show.
Thank you for having me. So it's so fun to be able to hear something before everyone else, you know, exclusive. And so, and, you know, just to kind of craft the conversation a little.
Mostly unfiltered idiocy.
Mostly.
Imagine what was definitely bad enough to cut.
It's a lot. I'm sure it's a lot sometimes.
Well, Kyle is going to be our MC for our lightning round absurdiversary episode. Kyle has in secret selected six of these questions, and here's how it's going to work. First of all, we're going to flip a coin to determine who is going to tackle the first one. And then Kyle is going to tell either Trace or I that question, and it'll be up to us to find that answer in 5 minutes.
Yeah, we have 5 minutes to Google or search or whatever it is that we need to do. I don't know, phone a friend if you have a physicist that you need to call or something. Do a journalism if you can do it in 5 minutes. And we can try and answer any of these questions however we can as quickly as possible. And then we have to answer it and give whatever the best answer that we can. We say this mainly because we're probably going to get some stuff wrong.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Like, that's kind of the fun of this episode is we're going to go through these questions. We're hopefully going to give you satisfying answers. But man, oh man, are we idiots. So this is going to be really hard.
We're really going to be on a time crunch. Go science now. Ah!
Ah! So you guys gave me absolutely no guidelines on this at all.
Yeah, like, that sounds right. That sounds like us.
Six or eight, and we'll roll with it. So some of these are a little more in depth than should be in a lightning round.
One or two of these. Thanks, Kyle.
Which I just wanted to, you know, give a little extra challenge. I know you guys are up for it.
Okay.
Okay, so I guess let's just get started, you know?
That's absurd. Please elaborate. Lightning round.
Julian, since you started the episode off, why don't you pick heads or tails?
Okay, I am going to say tails.
Hey Siri, flip a coin.
It's tails.
Woo!
It's tails.
Going first.
What you don't know is Trace has a shortcut. It's always tails.
Hey Siri, say the word tails.
Okay. All right. So Julian.
Yeah.
First up, Sean asks, would it actually be possible to write my name on the moon with a laser? Hi, I was listening to Hank Green's Lightly Competitive Science podcast, and in a recent episode, he got really excited about writing his name on the moon with a laser, Dr. Evil style. This got me thinking, what are the actual physics and engineering challenges involved in doing such a thing? Exactly how feasible is it? Doesn't feel like the sort of thing that couldn't actually be accomplished with enough money and permission.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay, Julian, please remove your headphones and Kyle and I are going to discuss.
Okay, get my attention when 5 minutes is up because I'm going to be in it.
Yes, we will wave. Okay, Kyle, here's what I think is going on. The problem with this is going to be focus. I remember learning once, if you shine a regular flashlight at the moon, the light kind of scatters all over the place. So it does actually reflect back, but it's so dim we can't really detect it without equipment. With a laser, of course, the Apollo astronauts dropped a reflector on the moon. So you could, if you could ostensibly point it at that exact bit, it will come back. But otherwise, by the time it comes back, it's something like hundreds of miles wide if you just shine it.
Yeah, it's also extremely dim. I read somewhere that it was just a few photons by the time it gets back.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with a gobo?
I don't know what that is.
Okay, so on a stage light, a gobo is like a laser cut pattern that they'll put in front of the light and it will display a shape.
Okay, gotcha.
You've probably seen them in hotel lobbies at conferences.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll have a light that shines and shows like the logo of the conference or whatever.
Right.
And so it's not like there's a tiny pattern in front of the laser. The way that those work is it's scanning.
It's constantly moving.
Yes. And it's moving so fast that we perceive it as one image. But the problem is that the laser would have to be huge.
Yeah.
And how are you going to move it that quickly? I don't think you can.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So this is going back to my childhood a little bit. Do you remember when Pizza Hut claimed that they were going to put their logo on the moon?
I vaguely remember this, but I don't remember the details.
I remembered this. Like, as soon as I saw this question, I was like, oh, yeah, I like Pizza Hut. And, and so I was curious to see how far back this went.
Yeah.
1999 is when they wanted to do this. All right. So I read that the logo would need to be the size of Texas for it to be visible.
To be visible to anyone, like, not on the moon, even with a telescope. Jeez.
At the time, scientists said that it would have cost hundreds of millions of dollars to just do it once.
Yeah. I mean, I think the moral of the story is the moon is real far away. And even though it's very big, it's actually really small, like in the sky. How was the 5 minutes, dude? First 5 minute research.
Are you kidding me?
When you have an objective like that, 5 minutes moves very quickly.
Oh my gosh, I'm like sweating. Oh my gosh, okay.
Athletic science communication.
I feel like I just like burned through so many calories in my brain. Okay, so Sean, the question again, right, was like, would it be possible to etch your name on the moon with a laser? Okay, so first thing that I wanted to look into, all right, how does laser etching work, right? This is a thing that we can do on like, oh, I remember years ago, like my iPod. Oh, I can get it laser engraved. So cool, right? Like what's the principle behind that? And it's pretty simple. It's just literally vaporizing the material. It's just putting enough energy into this material to like turn it into a vapor, basically just boil it. So we could theoretically, of course, with a laser, etch stuff into the moon. And I even found a handy dandy table of the vaporization temperature of certain materials.
Oh.
Including basalt, which is what the dark seas on the moon are made of. I could not believe my luck that this was on this table. I'm like, great, if we're going to etch it into, like, the mare of the moon, like, I've got at least something. Now, the thing is, the vaporization temperature that's given is between 1 to 3 atmospheres of pressure, right? If I remember my chemistry, if the temperature is lower in the ambient temperature, then the vaporization temperature is also going to drop. But anyway, as a baseline, basalt's vaporization temperature is 2,960 degrees Celsius at one atmosphere, which means the kilojoules per gram that you have to put into basalt is 3.9 kilojoules. So that much energy to vaporize 1 gram of basalt. So I have like some basis of energy that I'm looking for, right? 3.9 kilojoules. Now, my question is, do we make lasers that powerful? And I mean, yeah, we totally do. The most powerful laser is apparently 20 petawatts.
Oh, wow.
So watts is a measurement of power, right? It's like how much energy over time. So 20 petawatts means it delivers a ton of energy, you know, per
probably
second.
Probably in a really short time,
yeah,
right?
That's,
like femtoseconds.
Exactly. That's
crazy.
One way that you can raise a laser's power, basically, is by delivering the same amount of energy, but in less time because it's, you know,
powers.
Change in energy over time, shorter time,
right.
More power. Okay, great. But we have really powerful lasers. Now the question is, what is the challenge for actually shooting this laser at the moon and vaporizing this basalt? So with lasers, the power fades over distance, just like, I mean, everything. It depends on the quality of the beam itself, right? Like how just well your laser keeps that beam focused. The wavelength of the light you're using, a larger wavelength is going to have more divergence. So you want to use like a, you know, dark blue or purple or ultraviolet laser. And then also something called beam waste radius, the spot of the focus of the laser beam, right? And then past that, it'll diverge. And then, of course, if we're shooting from Earth, you're going to have it traveling through the atmosphere and, you know, parts of the beam will scatter as it hits dust, clouds, whatever in the atmosphere, right? So you're going to have enough power by the time it gets to the moon's surface to still vaporize.
Right.
I think that's possible. I also think the other engineering challenge that I didn't look into is you're going to need incredibly fine control of this laser beam, right? If you want to etch your name, and I like maybe your signature, my signature is a mess. Like I've signed for things at like a fast food drive through, and the person like clowned me once. She's like, really, that's your signature? And I'm like, yes, please be nice to me.
Doctors get away with it. What's wrong?
Yeah, it should have been
just
a
say
doctor.
You're a doctor.
Yeah,
just
excuse
be like,
you.
I'm a doctor.
I'm a doctor. Right. So like, I think my signature would be easier to make on the moon. But if you had a nice looking signature, you'd need this laser to have incredibly fine motion, unless you're also writing it like very big, in which case you're going to use up a lot more energy as you're like writing across this larger surface with this larger signature. But in terms of like, is it doable? Is it honestly? Yeah, probably. I think that, you know, our precision and our laser technology, I think we could conceivably write your name on the moon. Would there be a reason to do it? No. No, not really. Unless
street art, dude. Street art.
Yeah. Although, like, you know, all these billionaires that have their own space program, I'm surprised one of them didn't go like, and I'm going to write my name on the moon.
I'm surprised there's not like a lander that's its whole job is to just go up there, land a probe, and then write the name. I honestly wondered if that was the direction you would go. Be like, well, why shoot it from Earth?
Oh, well, I did consider, like, if we had a laser-based satellite, you know? Or, yeah, you could go and I suppose, land something on the moon and etch it directly. Didn't think of that. Dang it. I am really annoyed. You know, the Apollo 11 lander that's still there has a little plaque that has, like, oh, we humanity came to the moon, signed President Richard Nixon. And I'm like, I hate that Nixon gets to be the guy whose name's on the plaque on the moon forever. So annoying.
That's very the Queen died and there's a prime minister that's only in office for 2 weeks energy.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Anyway, I think that's a pretty good answer. So the answer to Sean is yeah, probably.
Yeah, probably. Listen, based on my 5 minutes of research, I'm going to go with yes.
Honestly, that's what we signed up for. Okay, next question.
Wait, I want to know what you two were talking about when I was sweating my butt off over here.
In 1999, Pizza Hut wanted to do it. They wanted to try this and publicly said they were going to. And the way that they were going to do it was a scanning laser. So it wasn't etching. It was just a display.
Smart.
What Kyle said the biggest problem was is control of that laser, which you totally nailed.
Yeah, I wanted to consider, like, is it possible at all just with the laser power that we have to vaporize basalt? Yeah, apparently. But yeah, then the consideration is, although I do like the idea of a scanning.
Depending on the phase of the moon, you would have a lot better luck.
New moon.
Yeah.
But you'd need a really powerful, still really powerful laser.
Well, now it's Trace's turn in the hot seat. I'm kind of relieved I've got the first one out of the way. Kyle.
Yeah.
What's Trace's challenge?
So JW asks, how far does my car go on an average-sized dinosaur?
I love this one. I love this one.
Okay, so that question is a teeny bit flawed. Well, it does not really come from dinosaurs themselves. It comes from plants and organisms that lived long, long before the dinosaurs. So I pivoted the question a little bit.
Okay.
The median weight for a dinosaur is around 1,400 pounds. How much oil would 1,400 pounds of algae or whatever eventually become? And so I'm just kind of displacing the dinosaur with something else.
All right, here I go. Ready? I'm taking my headphones off. 5 minutes on the clock.
So apparently the dinosaur thing came from the gas company. It's in California. I can't remember the name of it. Is it Sunoco or something?
Sinclair.
Yes. So in the 30s, they adopted the dinosaur as their logo. That's apparently how that got started.
That's so funny.
Like people associated oil with dinosaurs.
Or like all the jokes about how like turning, you know, oil into plastic dinosaurs is turning dinosaurs into dinosaurs.
It's so funny that an oil company's marketing perpetuated that myth.
Yeah, it's wild when you start looking into a lot of things that like are fun facts and they're horrifically wrong, and they all start at like there's a famous one from like, oh, the Great Wall of China is visible from space, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. But like the first time that was published anywhere was like in the 1800s, which was obviously way before anybody had ever been to space. So it's like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, that's just a thing. And I was told it as a kindergartner, I remember. And now I'm like, that's in my brain forever. And it's like, how is it that this misinformation, like, is so easy to, like, implant and so difficult to dislodge? Now, that fact, though, that I remember just some guy in the 1800s, like, wrote it in a book. Of like amazing facts, and it's like, oh, okay, now we all nobody questioned, like, how would you know?
Hey, how high does that hot air balloon go? I don't think
space.
It's
space. I took it to space. you dare question me?
Hello, I'm back.
Welcome.
This is insane. Who did this? Who decided to do this?
This is a terrible idea. Nobody's going to get any useful information out of this.
This is all you guys.
Why are we doing this? Oh, no. Trace, we need to quit before we have a second anniversary.
Wow. You guys, I got to hang out.
It's difficult, right? It's stressful.
It's so stressful. Okay. I've got an answer, I think. We'll see if my notes make any sense.
Oh, God.
Okay. Okay. So, JW, your question was, how far does my car go on the average-sized dinosaur? Kyle was kind enough to provide me in the median weight of a dinosaur, 1,400 pounds.
That was nice. That was a freebie.
Super
wow.
Great for me.
Why didn't I get the vaporization energy of basalt? Huh? Kyle?
It was in the table. It was in the table. Come on.
It was in the table. You found a table.
Yeah, you totally
it was great.
Knew that. He's got it all planned out.
He's already done all this research for us.
He's like a puppet master manipulating the strings.
So I started out by thinking, okay, well, what is gasoline? Gasoline comes from the crude oil. How much crude oil does it take to make a gallon of gasoline? It's roughly double. So you have to, you get about half from crude oil, about half of it, if you refine it, can become gasoline that we use in our cars. And then they do make other products from the crude oil. It's not like they throw away the rest or it disappears. You know, they use it for all sorts of different things. But then I started running into a dead end. I was like, okay, but now I need to know how much makes 2 gallons of crude oil, which led me to a study called Burning Buried Sunshine, Human Consumption of Ancient Solar Energy. It was done in, I think, the late 90s, now that I haven't looked, so I'm not going to go back and look. But anyway, they had a really interesting calculation to figure out how much carbon was in the vegetation that was buried under the ground, because it is basically ancient solar energy that powered these plants. Those plants died, and then they got compressed years of, you know, pressure, et cetera, to make crude
They were
oil.
Asked to do many lightning rounds, and the pressure squeezed them into coal.
Yeah. Here's what they wrote. A staggering 98 tons of prehistoric plant material, that is 196,000 pounds, is required to produce 1 gallon of gasoline.
Oh, my gosh.
That's a ridiculous amount.
How many pounds?
196,000 pounds to produce each gallon of gasoline that we burn in our cars. So that's a good place to start. Yeah. And that sort of answers the question, sort of. They also then looked into the amount of fossil fuels in the year 1997 that were burned, about 90 million billion pounds of carbon, which is wild. That's a lot of frickin' carbon that we were burning.
It's only gone up, baby.
So 97 million billion pounds of carbon. That is equivalent, in case you're wondering, to 400 times more than all the plant matter that grows on the whole world, including microscopic ocean plants, in a year. 400 times more. And we burned it in 1 year.
And again, this
1997.
Is 90s figures when our consumption was lower than it is today.
Yes.
Suddenly I'm worried about running out of oil, Trace.
You know what? I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, but maybe it's not great. Maybe it's not great to build your entire economy on a thing that you can burn and not reuse.
Anyway.
I don't think I realized the ratio was that bad.
It's pretty insane.
That is so much. So I did a little bit of back of the napkin math, which my notes look like a crazy person wrote them.
Etched them on the moon.
Yes. One of the quotes from the researcher said, you'd have to have 40 acres worth of wheat. That's including all of the plant material in all 40 acres, their stalks, their roots, everything. And you would put that into the tank of your car every 20 miles in order to drive. So I was like, oh, well, if I wanted to get a little less, then I can try and figure out exactly how much that might be. So if we look down, there's about 40 bushels of wheat per acre, and that's about 4,224 pounds of wheat that is harvested, plus 6,335 wheat stubble. Now, I didn't have time to look up what wheat stubble is, so I don't know if...
Don't you hate it when you think you've got a good handle and then another term comes up that you're like, what? I have to learn this whole new category?
So I don't know if...
Happens a lot.
Right. I don't know if wheat stubble is like all the roots and everything, but I assumed it was based on my limited amount of time. We end up with about 9,500 kilograms of plant matter to get 1 mile in a thing, which is a similar amount. It's a lot less than what a gallon of gasoline would be, right? We're only going part of a gallon of gasoline. So about a mile is about 20,000 pounds or 9,500 kilograms. And if we use the 635 kilograms or 1,400 pound dinosaur,
it's going to be like dinosaurs per mile and not the other way
around.
Right.
It's like 14 or 15 dinosaurs, because then if they're 635 kilograms, you multiply that by 14, you get about 21,000-ish kilograms. So then that's how much you need of matter to go a mile. That's assuming, of course, that dinosaurs and plant material are equivalent, and they are definitely not. Because again, Kyle nailed it right out of the gate. Plants, not dinosaurs. There are no dinosaurs that make oil. It's all ancient plant material from ancient seas and things like that. So luckily for me, some other nerd has already done a lot of that math, and I just had to find the study.
Oh, lucky you indeed.
Lucky me. So that's your answer, JW. How far does your car go on an average-sized dinosaur? Not far at all. Wouldn't even go...
1/14th of a mile?
Yeah, wouldn't even go a mile. but you'd need 15 dinosaurs or something to go 1 mile. And then you'd really, if you wanted a like equivalent of gasoline, multiply it by your miles per gallon. So if you get a crappy mile per gallon, you're looking at a whole herd of dinosaurs to literally go down the street. Walk, JW, walk.
No wonder that T-Rex in Jurassic Park hated those Jeeps so much.
Be like, you're burning my ancestors!
My family!
That's my uncle!
Okay, I expected like a gallon. Yeah. I really did. I thought it would be like, yeah, 1,400 pounds to... It's not even close.
No, it's a ridiculous amount. I mean, that 98 tons of prehistoric buried plant material is required to produce each gallon of gasoline. I was like, that's it. I found the answer. From here, I can work with a lot. But that is so much. 196,000 pounds. That's 196,000 freedom units is 89,000 kilograms?
That's a lot
of plant material to make 1 gallon of gasoline. Now, if you think about all that gallons of gasoline that we're burning, like how many gallons you put in your car, that's how many, like how many millions of plants every time you fill up.
That's incredible.
It's crazy. This is a crazy system we have built. Do not do this anymore. Let's stop.
I don't know, guys. I don't think this is sustainable.
Yeah, no. Now, I'm no expert.
Something's telling me.
Now, I've done a total of 5 minutes of research, but I think...
Have you ever looked at the range of dinosaur weights, by the way?
No. No. You know what? Tell me more, Kyle.
I haven't. Tell me more, yeah.
I found a table. The lowest is about 5 pounds.
Okay. Yeah.
Tiny.
The highest was like 50,000 pounds.
I mean, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the range is incredible.
Yeah.
Which made me have a little side question.
Oh.
What if we directly converted chickens to fuel? You know, I don't know how that works. I don't know if you just like squeeze the hell out of them and it's oil.
Wow.
Or if it's like a calories to miles per gallon. I don't know.
I mean, Kyle,
I think we cut out the middleman and just go with corn. We've already done that. The chicken eats corn.
It's true.
There, I know this podcast you should send that question to.
Yeah, right? The issue, right, is like the fuel that we burn is a hydrocarbon, right? It's like a long chain of carbons and hydrogens, right? And that, when you combine it with oxygen and then you ignite it, you release the energy in those bonds. So you're going to have to take a chicken, which has a lot of not carbon in it. And yeah. I have, frankly, no. I mean, yeah, you'd have to squeeze it, but like with like the pressure of the Earth's crust above you, right?
Yeah.
Which is why we have oil and coal and stuff deep underground. So you've got to like force
heat and pressure, baby.
These carbons and hydrogens to join up. So really what you're asking is, on your average chicken, how much carbon and hydrogen, like what's the percentage of mass that makes that up? And if you could perfectly combine it to make octane.
Assuming you could perfectly do it, how much? Yeah. I mean, that's just a math question.
You can't really go straight calories to...
probably could. I mean, it's a calories of fuel. It's a type of fuel. It's just a different
The question,
mechanism.
Right, is like gasoline. Yeah. And in that case, we have to have the carbon-hydrogen bonds, right?
Yeah.
Because like we can use food for energy because we're breaking apart bonds, you know, with enzymes and stuff to release energy in those bonds, but it's not as it's much more complicated than the way an internal combustion engine works of just like squirt, air, spark, boom.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to our next question.
Okay, Julian.
Yes.
Edward asks, could we pop the Earth?
Could we pop the Earth?
Oh my God, I love it.
He goes on, so if an indestructible rope was wrapped around the Earth, pulled at both ends with gradually increasing force, would the Earth eventually pop? And this one just made me laugh.
Okay, all right. All right, I'm on it.
Okay, timer starts now. So wait, say his question again?
If an indestructible rope was wrapped around the Earth and pulled at both ends with gradually increasing force, would the Earth pop?
Like the watermelon experiment where you put the rubber bands around it?
Yeah.
I mean, the answer's got to be yes. I would think so, but wow. The rope being indestructible is an important... I'm glad that you know, they included that, because...
It's not the first time that's come up on this podcast.
Yeah. Jeez, what do you think, Kyle? You've thought about this for a while.
I did, and does a geode pop?
Mm.
No, you smash the hell out of it with a hammer.
Yeah, it crushes in the middle more than it would pop.
Yeah, so it's not exactly going to pop.
Right.
But it is one to break apart.
Is the question really, does Earth have some kind of surface tension? Right, like a watermelon. The watermelon was the first thing I thought of. You put the rubber bands around the watermelon, you keep adding them, and eventually your slow-mo camera gets to make a viral YouTube video. But otherwise, like, that watermelon wants to hold itself together. The Earth has no such want. It wants to be as small as possible. Gravity is pulling it toward its center, right? So they're just they're fundamentally different. The watermelon doesn't really apply, but like just the reason that they're round are completely different. I would think that the indestructible rope would just crush it because it's really...
Or just cut it in half.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so the little drawings that we always see in our science books that have the layers of the Earth across. And okay, the center of the Earth is liquid, right?
Well, it's an iron core, probably liquid iron. Yeah, melted, yeah.
Spinning. Melted. How big is that?
Big, real big.
Like, are they drawn to scale?
Yeah, they draw them to scale. I'd have to Google it to know, and I feel like that'd be cheating. But I know it's big. I would imagine off the top of my head without having looked anything up, I would say it's something like smaller than Mercury/Pluto. You know, like it's a small orb. But it's still huge relative to anything we can imagine. The crust is so thin. Like, we think of it as thick because we're teeny tiny little, not even ants, like bacteria on the surface of the Earth. But like, it's so thin. Yeah. If you squished the Earth, like if you were a celestial from the Marvel movies and you just smushed the Earth with your hands, it would probably flex, right? Like, it would probably be like, brong, 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 you know? Because it's mostly liquid, like molten, not liquid. Okay. Sorry, pedants.
Right.
Yeah.
Side question. So we've got this. We got this rope. It pull relatively hard.
Yeah.
Do our volcanoes pop like zits all over the world?
This is a great question, and honestly, a really good B movie.
Zit volcano.
I mean, whether it's a rope or Thanos' hands or whatever, if you squish it.
Is like molten material going to come out of the cracks and the volcanoes? And like, I would think that would be the first step. Wow.
Yeah.
And would that count as popping? What is popping? Man, this podcast brings up a lot of questions.
I think of internal pressure.
Yeah.
Like a balloon.
Yeah,
you know, something that is pushing on its outside, and that's the exact opposite of how the Earth is working.
Or again, like surface tension, where like the balloon, if you poke it, you've broken the surface tension and let out everything inside. Oh, I'm interested. We got 10 seconds left. The 5 minutes go so fast. All right. 3, 2, 1. Welcome back, Julian.
I just want to say, I think I had the answer about 2 minutes ago. I was just double checking.
Hey, that's right. That's my boy right there. Science communicate. We had a really interesting talk about this question, so I'm excited for this answer.
Okay, so Edward's question was, specifically, we need to take like a unbreakable cable of some kind, right? Mm-hmm. And we wrap it around the Earth, and then we just start ratcheting up pressure, right? I don't know, we twist some like end of it with a big stick, I don't know, and we just keep adding pressure. Does the Earth pop? Edward, no.
Dun, dun, dun.
Definitively. Whoa. I'm sure of this.
Definitively?
I'm sure of this.
Whoa.
And I took some inspiration from an episode that I wasn't on. Yeah. The one hosted with Matt Kroll when you asked about ice skating.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, wow.
Now, you remember, originally, for a long time, the explanation, the hypothesis on how ice skating worked was the skater puts their body weight on that very narrow point of the skate's blade, right?
Right.
Well, technically, yeah. As a hockey player, I have to say, there's two edges. There's an inside edge and an outside edge. But anyway, so there's these two very narrow edges on either side of that metal, right? You concentrate all that force into a small area, which is pressure, right?
Mm.
Force over an area, that's pressure. So because the area is very small, you have high pressure, right?
Right.
Now, the thinking was back then that causes the ice to melt because ice is less dense in its solid form. So when you put pressure on it and actually compact it, you turn it back into a liquid. So that explanation, as discussed in that episode with Trace, we know that's not how it works. But the principle is not still invalid. That's still true. There's demonstrations you can see where people will take like a block of ice and they'll have like a thin wire. They'll press down with all their body weight on this wire, and the wire will carve through this ice. I think of the Earth in this scenario in a similar way. If we have this cable, you know, this magical, mithril, indestructible cable, and we're using it to ratchet up the pressure and we keep upping it and upping it and upping it, we're not going to pop the Earth like if you were to do that with an egg or something. And we're not going to like melt through the crust either. But I do think we'll start slicing through it, like at a local level where this cable is digging into this rock, it's gonna start cracking through it and slicing through it.
What?
And you're just gonna keep basically burrowing deeper and deeper and deeper into the Earth. Now, here's what I think is probably the coolest part is like once you get to the mantle, which isn't liquid, by the way, something I learned recently, which kind of upended my whole life. But the mantle is like a solid layer still, but it's viscous on like long time scales. It only becomes this liquid magma under special conditions, like when the pressure above it is lowered because like the tectonic plates are spreading apart, right?
Wow.
Well, imagine you get to this mantle layer with your cable and you're digging into it, and then you get past it a little bit and the mantle above where your cable is now all of a sudden has all this pressure relieved. Then it's going to turn into a liquid, a magma, or I guess lava if it's exposed to the surface, right? And so it's probably going to flow up into this giant like gash that you've made and start resealing that hole with volcanic rock.
Whoa.
Right? Also consider that the Earth is not, you know, like under a pressure the way the sun is, right? Like the sun has fusion going on in the core and that's providing an outward pressure and that's balanced against gravity.
Yeah.
Earth doesn't have anything like that providing, I mean, you've got like the heat and pressure and whatnot and like radiative heat coming from the mantle and stuff. But like there's no real big outward force where like if you cause like a balloon where
there's nothing exploding in the
middle outside in any way, it's just going to pop, right?
Right.
You've got the force of gravity that's pulling the Earth all towards the center of its mass anyway. So the Earth, I mean, it formed because gravity pulled all of this matter together, right?
Yeah.
So it's not going to just disassemble and fly outwards in all directions if anything pierces the exterior like a balloon does.
Right. Wow.
So,
ugh.
So I think I can pretty safely conclude, Edward, with this excellent question, that no, the Earth is not going to pop if you put a giant unbreakable rope around it and squeezed. You're just going to eventually have your unbreakable and presumably priceless rope buried deep, deep down in the Earth's crust.
Right. The loop would disappear into the Earth and you'd just end up with a rope through the Earth.
Yeah.
Huh.
You can't even cut the Earth in half. So not only can you not pop it, you can't cut it in half.
Right. Not in this method.
You wind up just skewering it just, the Earth.
Gravity just pulls it back together again. Even if the lava didn't or the molten material didn't re-solidify, it would still want to stay a ball.
Yeah. If you slice the Earth in half, you'd probably need you need to do it really quick and then like separate the halves so they could form their own half.
Well, and separate them far enough that their mutual gravity doesn't
pull them together. I mean, they probably would pull themselves together again anyway.
Even if you put them somewhere else.
And then give it enough time and it'll form a sphere again because obviously we have enough mass.
That's so cool. Julian, that's so cool. Okay.
I did not expect that at all.
Yeah. I did not either. Yeah, that was awesome.
At first I was like, why not? And then I was like, wait, consider the physics.
Think for a minute.
No, think. No. I don't see any reason why that would pop the Earth.
But now that we're about halfway through, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. If you've turned into this... Turned into it? You've turned into one.
You've turned into a science comedy podcast. Oh, no. Oh, no. I'm a podcast. Am I going to be late to work?
If you're tuned into this science and comedy podcast, chances are that you are someone who loves learning and having a blast while doing it.
If it wasn't clear, Trace and I are the same way. We thrive on learning new things because it not only enriches our lives, helps us learn new skills, but also makes us really cool at parties.
Is that what we are at parties?
Aren't we? We are, right? We're cool.
I mean, when you're at my house and I'm at your house, definitely, but like... other houses.
Anyway, this is all to say, I am super excited about our new sponsor, Brilliant.
Yay!
Can I kind of get a little, like, you know, in my feels for a second?
Oh, yeah. Get those feels. Elaborate, please.
Hey, I see what you did there. I am exactly the kind of person that Brilliant was made for. I have always been interested in math, physics, computer science. When I had the chance to study these things in college years ago, I was also really intimidated by them.
Yeah.
And I avoided taking these classes. And honestly, I regret it. I'm going back now. I'm taking classes at my local community college. I'm loving it.
Yeah.
But with a family and work, traditional classes like that, I'm finding them really hard to actually fit into my life. So I was really excited when you told me that Brilliant was going to be a sponsor.
That's awesome, man. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
If you don't know what it is, by the way, out there,
it's an interactive learning platform with so many lessons on topics that I always wanted to explore, and I can do them at my own pace, on my schedule, and in a way that keeps me engaged.
You can learn by doing on their website or with their mobile apps, and there are thousands of different interactive lessons in STEM subjects all across the platform.
Their lessons are engaging and interactive.
You can brush up on, like, algebra or advanced math, multivariable calculus, differential equations,
computer science, Python programming. You can even learn about cutting edge stuff like large language models, neural networks, the things that are powering AI today.
Large language models, really big right now.
Large language models.
You can learn large language models.
It's only Gaelic, though. The large language that you can learn is Gaelic.
Yeah, ship that. I'm in.
We can finally communicate with the Scots.
Okay, well, anyway. Wherever you are in your learning journey, there is a Brilliant course that will help you get to the next level. Or, you know, just be basic enough to get you an understanding that you can go and work with.
Yeah, they're always adding new courses too. They just launched a ton of lessons focused on analyzing data.
That's cool. That's really cool.
I think the world would be a better place if everyone had to take a stats class.
Oh, totally.
And if you haven't taken one, here's your chance.
You could just go take a statistics class and make Julian so, so happy.
I would appreciate that.
Try it out.
You can try Brilliant for free for 30 days. Just visit brilliant.org/absurd or click the link in the show notes.
Once again, that's brilliant.org/absurd.
When you sign up, you'll get 20% off the annual premium subscription, and it supports the show, even just trying it out.
So go ahead, check it out, maybe get sucked into a few lessons. Trace and I are going to be here with the rest of the episode when you get back. If you get back.
Oh, I hope you get back.
They come back and they know more than us about everything.
They're just like, these guys are idiots.
Their brains are the size, the huge brain coming out of their cranium. I've absorbed all knowledge.
Why do I listen to this podcast of dummies?
I have no time for your absurd antics.
But I would definitely take one on large language models.
A
cool
Scottish AI robot that nobody can understand.
Sorry, turn on the lights! Sorry!
I'm the burglar alarm.
It supports the show. It'll be great.
Welcome back to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. Next question comes from Ben, and it's going to Trace. What is the highest speed that any part of your body could reach purely under your own power? This is probably just a sports question, like what's faster, the tips of a pitcher's fingers mid-throw or the toe of a soccer player kicking a ball? But I can't help but imagine that there could be some other weird way you could use one finger or one toe move just a bit faster.
Trace, you'll love this. More math. All right. Get out the napkins.
Yes. Woohoo! Okay, I'm off. Ready? Start the timer.
Okay, when a pitcher hurls a fastball, right, and they throw 100 miles an hour, that means their hand was moving 100 miles an hour at release, right? Because nothing else is accelerating the ball right after release. So therefore, like, we kind of have a pretty accurate measurement of, like, their hand is going 100 miles an hour. And that's with, you know, a mass in it that they had to accelerate. So if you take away the mass of the baseball, you know, you could probably get it a little faster, right? If you're just doing the end of your arm. You know what? It would be interesting to get into when Trace answers it, that question of how are we measuring the speed? Are we measuring pure kilometers per hour? Are we measuring degrees per second? Are we measuring acceleration?
So a baseball player is essentially cracking a whip, and the whip is their freaking arm.
Yeah.
That's,
I mean, it is pretty
crazy
wild
to think about.
Like, I mean, the tip of a whip makes a crack because it's a sonic boom. Yeah. And the speed of sound at sea level is about 740 miles an hour. So that's pretty wild. But that's, yeah. So that's how fast that tip of the whip is going. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Oh, God, that would hurt so much. And when you think about it, you know, your arm is not your longest limb, and your arm muscles are not your strongest muscles. So, like, I'm thinking about your leg. How fast could you get the tip of your foot going? I don't know. I'm not a kinesiologist. Kinesiology is always tough for me whenever I have an answer related to it.
And more importantly, how fast can you make it go and still slow it down without breaking your leg?
Yeah, right?
Because that's an important
snap
bit as well.
Snap that sucker right off. All right, should we bring Trace back?
Yes.
Hello. I think this one went well. I feel pretty confident in my answer. We'll just have to see how you like it. Okay, so Ben, the highest speed any part of a body could reach under their own power. Most people are going to go immediately to sports, which I get, you know. Fingertip, toe, that all makes sense because, and for people who may not know, you know, you have your wingspan or you have your length of your leg. And if you swing your leg, then your toe is moving really fast relative to the joint of your hip, and your joint of your shoulder is moving very slow relative to the tip of your finger, right? Your actual movement distance, or the speed is, you know, distance traveled over time, is much faster.
Right.
The fastest kick that I could find was about 136 miles an hour, and it's not in sports.
Whoa.
Though. You know, it's like fighting in like fighting sports in martial arts. So about 200 and some kilometers per hour. You know, the average fart, as we learned, is about 11 or 6.8 miles per hour. Because I was trying to think outside the box. I'm like, there's got to be something that moves more quickly that maybe we throw or is like under our own power, something
right.
That's moving.
Flicking a booger.
A boxer punches at about 35 miles an hour, about 55 kilometers an hour. So those are all pretty fast, right? The kick of a martial artist being 136 is pretty ridiculous. But when you like throw a baseball, that's also really, really fast. The fastest thing in the human body was the first thing that I searched for. And that comes out actually as the muscles that control eye blinking.
Okay.
The thing is, it depends how we're thinking about speed, right?
This
is
I knew you were going to say that.
This is reaction time.
Kyle, did I say that?
Nailed it.
Is the fastest thing in the human body is the orbicularis oculi, and it snaps the eye shut in less than 100 milliseconds. Less than that. So less than 0.1 seconds. Very, right. Very, very fast. It takes about a third of a second to complete the whole blink, but most of that is the opening of it. The closing of it is extremely quick. And that's because it's 90% type 2 myofibers, so like really fast twitch facial muscles. So if we assume like a 12 millimeter iris and that the eyelid is just on top and bottom of the iris, because I couldn't find a good measurement for like how far the eye opens and how far it travels, that's still not very fast if you're thinking of it compared to like a kick. It's only like 0.2 miles an hour because it's not going very far. So then I found the Journal of the Royal Society Interface, which they say something else is faster than an eye blink, even a finger snap. So they think the highest speed any body part could reach under its own power might be the finger snap, because it moves across the finger in 7 milliseconds. And it's actually quite a lot of speed. They said it's 7,800 degrees of movement per second, which is three times faster than a pro baseball player throws a baseball at 100 miles an hour. So like, that's very fast, way faster than things would move. But they used an arm instead of a fingertip. So I think we really come down to like, this is one of those math questions that you could just dig into forever. And a sports scientist would just pick a person and then measure that person's speed, the speed of that person's fingertip. Because if you took the tallest person in the world, 8 feet, 1 inch, and had that wingspan just naturally spinning in a circle, it's going to be way faster than someone with a wingspan of 6 feet, or, you know, or somebody with a wingspan of 4 feet. You know, they're all the speed is going to be something that you could calculate. And there probably is a top speed of that. But like, if you got a baseball player who's also 7 feet tall and could throw really fast, like their fingertips are going to move way faster than you would even assume, you know,
like the big unit, Randy Johnson, if anybody's a baseball fan.
Yeah, exactly.
Guy was huge.
Right.
Huge.
Exactly.
And like Hall of Fame pitcher. Yeah. And we, Kyle and I actually discussed this a little bit while you were doing the research, because we couldn't help ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually said exactly a lot of this stuff. Like, yes, your finger is going like so fast, but what are we defining the speed as? Are we defining it in meters per second, or are we defining it in degrees per second, right? Right. How fast this rotation actually goes around a circle. And to get speed in meters per second, you'd have to multiply, like, you know, the distance of the limb or the finger or whatever, and that degrees per second. So even though a baseball player's arm isn't rotating as many degrees per second because it's so much longer than a finger, the speed at the tips is faster.
Yeah.
But yeah, wait. A professional baseball pitcher snapping mid-pitching motion.
Yep.
See,
that's it.
See, I was actually...
That has to be it.
I didn't get to it, but I think it might be something else. I think it might be a professional Olympic gymnast doing a spin in the air. Or a figure skater doing a spin on the ice. I didn't get to that in my research because there's so many different things that you could go and be like, well, which one's the longest one? Which one's the furthest from our center of gravity? Because that's all you need. It's not about what sport you use, and it's not even really about how fast they are. It's how, what is the thing that spins the quickest and is furthest from the center point? And I would argue if you have two Olympic figure skaters and one is holding the other one while they fly through the air, the tip of their, you know, like, I guess they wouldn't be under their power, but like, you know, the tips of their bodies, if they spin, are going to be moving quite quickly. Like, they can do four spins. The best spinners can do four spins in a second. So it's just like you're talking a ridiculous amount of just degrees of movement in a short period.
Actually, that's a great point. So the thing about how gymnasts spin and figure skaters spin, right, you'll notice that, like, they seem like they can twirl really, really, really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of the conservation of angular momentum that they're taking advantage of, right? So
they're spinning, like, fast already, and then they tuck in. So they're spinning faster.
Right, because the formula for angular momentum is your mass times your velocity times your radius. Mm-hmm. Their mass isn't changing, obviously, but if their radius gets smaller,
their velocity
then
goes up.
The velocity of the spin has to get bigger.
Yeah.
So if they snap while they do that,
if they snap their fingers,
if they tuck in and then they snap, and you could measure the
if
speed
they snap
of their finger
while they're tucking.
Yeah.
So they're accelerating as they're snapping, then I think that would be the fastest you could probably go under your.
That's really cool. I'm glad we got to the same place. Like, I was telling Julian, I was teaching my son how to snap. And when I saw this question, that's immediately what I thought of was, I can't think of anything that I can do that's faster.
Like I said, I'm not super confident in my math. So when I do math questions, I take a long time to make sure that I quadruple check everything and then run it through, you know, Wolfram Alpha or wherever, because I don't want to mess it up. I started thinking about it more like the playing the music rather than writing the music, or like they said in Oppenheimer, right? Instead of doing the math, do you like see the music of it? And I feel like that's where my head goes when I try to see the music, is like, who spins the fastest? I also do think, and this is, you know, a little sidebar, I think we tend to think of men kicking, punching, and throwing, as opposed to people who aren't always men spinning and like dancing. Like, ballerinas spin really freaking fast and their legs are out. You know, we don't think of that as speed, but it's very fast.
When you said the bit about music, it made me think. I'm from the South, and so there's a lot of guitar picking and banjo picking that happens around. And some of that is incredibly fast.
Yeah. I mean, even in the 5 minutes I was doing research, a lot of the stuff that comes up is like, again, macho things, because it's competitive and it's like quick draws and punches and, you know, stuff like that.
Well, cool. I appreciate how you tackled that one.
Thank you. All right, Kyle, what is Julian's third and final lightning round question?
Oh, the stress. I'm so glad it's almost over.
Okay. Mark asks, what is the best food to make a house out of?
Oh.
What? I love this one.
Oh. Interesting.
Julian, how come you get this one?
Mark goes on, my partner was trying to stand her burrito on its end to see how long it would stay
standing. I know exactly this feeling.
Yeah, that's...
And it got me to thinking that burritos would be a terrible construction material.
Unless you make them into logs.
Wait, don't answer my question for me, Trace. Go on, Kyle.
Sorry.
Then I thought, well, if burritos are out, what else should I use? I feel like the classic gingerbread house is a terrible choice because it would dissolve in the rain.
Okay, so we need something weatherproof.
Okay, here we go. 5 minutes on the clock.
All right, here I go.
Go. Kyle, do you have thoughts?
One thought. He's thinking about a processed, fully cooked burrito, right? I think it would be easier to go raw material, like dry corn, and stack those and kind of grout them together or something. I don't know.
Are we going by Food Network rules where everything has to be edible, you know, except for the dowels or whatever in the cake, all the cake has to be edible? Or are we going by your point, if I took kernels of something, but then I wrapped them in just regular old glue, you know, I would think it would have to be edible. And so my first thought is something like a really dense, like a fruitcake situation where they're like quite dense, you know, quite heavy. But you'd also want something that's like not going to dissolve. And in the rain, food is going to dissolve. I mean, that's just how it is.
It is.
Unless you put a lot of gelatin in it. Like how technical are we be? How pedantic are we going to be? Like, you could make a brick of gelatin. Would you want to eat it? No. It's edible, though.
What about ramen? Have you seen these crazy videos where people will take ramen and do like car body work with them?
No.
Yes, they'll take ramen and wet it slightly, put it in a dent, and work it like Bondo.
What?
Yes. I don't think that the videos are fake. I just think that at the first hint of any pressure or water,
it just looks good for the video. Like, I think the weather might be going too far. Let's say we're in a desert environment, just because adding all of the weather to it is tough. But in a desert environment, what could we make? Bamboo you can eat too if you're a panda. Sure. Let me think. I can't think of anything. This is going to be really tough. I feel like you said it was a softball to make him feel better about it. How long does this house have to last? Like, if you just got a bunch of steaks, like a whole bunch of them, how long could, you know, because it'd probably still be cold inside. If you got enough steaks and you built like a hut out of steaks, beef
you'd
steaks.
You'd have every dog in the neighborhood chewing your house.
You'd have to find a way to cover up the outside. All of this sounds really gross.
It does.
What about potatoes?
Oh.
You can eat them.
Okay, they have a really long shelf life. You could just pin them together. Yeah. Like toothpick them together.
You could cut them into bricks. Little teeny bricks. If you want to do the work.
That would take a while.
We're building a house here, Kyle.
You know, Kyle said that was a softball. What kind of hell is your adult softball league like, Kyle? What? Okay.
I said this exact same thing as soon as you got off the mic.
Here's the problem. Food is food because we can break it down. And things that we build things out of are things that we build things out of because they're not easy to break down. Do you see the inherent conflict here? Right.
Right. He's asking for the Venn diagram. Right. Stuff that we can digest and stuff that nature can't digest.
Now, I'm no expert because I put a grand total of 5 minutes into this. But I found nothing.
really?
My first thought before the context came up of gingerbread was like, oh, but gingerbread, easy, slam dunk, lock it up, let's go home. No, right? Yeah. Because Mark is like, not satisfied with gingerbread. If it rains, you know, it gets all mushy, and that's the end of that. And I'm like, wait a minute, I've got to build some sort of, like, at least semi-permanent edifice out of food?
Which, by its very nature, is temporary. Food is temporary.
Like, food rots, right? What's happening when food is rotting? Well, microbes are breaking apart those bonds, and they're going to town, and they're consuming it, and they're putting out waste, and that's why it smells gross and will make you sick if you eat it, right? Because something is eating it, essentially. At a microscopic level, it is being consumed because that's what it's good for. The bonds that hold it all together are breakable by these microbes, and then they can extract the sweet, good, you know, energy that's stored within it. Now, food.
Julian, are you just defining food over and over again?
Okay, now building material, right? Like wood, okay? Wood, cellulose.
Sure.
These cellulose. Plant fibers are held together. They're made of a lot. I've said this, I feel like, multiple times on the show, right? But they're fundamentally, the building blocks are the same between like plant fiber and plant starch, but the way that they are combined together, yep, is much more difficult to break. And that's why it's not worth it for you to actually digest it and pull it apart, right? Unless you didn't have any other source of food, like your termite or something. But like, if your option is like, ooh, all these readily available sugars in an apple, or the frickin' trunk of the apple tree, it's easier to go for the apple. Okay.
Yeah.
But we can't do that. We're not allowed to do that. There are non-organic sources, right? You could have like a clay hut that's, you know, you just basically get some water and dirt mixed together and you shape it. And then when the water evaporates, like, cool, now you're just left with the solid shaped dirt, concrete, cement. We've talked about this in the past, actually. It's interesting that the water doesn't evaporate when concrete is setting. It's actually like forming crystals with the compound and like crystallizing it, hydrolyzed. It's very, very cool. Yeah, I know. Fun fact.
Yeah.
But again, right, they're forming these like very difficult to break, rigid.
The microbes that exist in nature, which are not hugely different from the microbes,
right,
that exist
and
inside,
like,
of us, don't
the
break them
down. The
thing
about him specifying, oh, well, if it gets wet, that makes it, you know, go soggy. Sure, there's like things that are yeah, water soluble, but then another thing you have to consider with water is it provides a necessary component for a lot of these microbes to actually do their digestion. This is a reason that, you know, if you want to preserve without refrigeration, like if you want to preserve meat or like, you know, mummies, it's good to do it by putting them, mm-hmm, somewhere very cool and dry, right? Salt them because
to remove
yeah, water from the microbes. It'll kill them.
Yeah.
And anyway, so,
come on, Julian, spit it out. Let's go.
I wish I'd left before the context was given because it would have made it easier, right? But now you're like, oh, it rains and then it goes bad. Like, you just made it impossible for me. But I did think, okay, well, you know, what are some kind of building block material like foods? And I kind of like the idea of peanut brittle. I feel like, okay,
peanut brittle. It's like a
yeah,
hard caramel
really
with peanuts.
Yeah, it's hard and dense, and like I feel like it would take a lot of effort, even though there's a lot of sugar, for like microbes to burrow through it, and it would hold up well to getting wet. I wish I could test it. I was trying to find if anybody's just got, you know, like, how well does peanut brittle so like hold up when you get wet? Can you believe the internet didn't have that? but yeah, something like that. Or if we can use other parts, like banana leaves are useful for like thatched hut roofs, right? But we're not using the banana leaves. We gotta use, I guess, not even the peel. Not even
no,
the
we can't
peel.
Eat those.
So Mark, I don't think there's a food that meets your criteria. I think you could do it if you were willing to basically accept that your house would be very temporary. But yeah, you would probably want something, depending on where you live, too. Like if you dealt with earthquakes or something, right, like we do in California, you want something flexible. So wood is good for structures out here because it can bend without breaking. So a food like that, maybe jerky, although I don't think it's got the structural rigidity really to hold up, unless you bundled it together. But yeah, if you were somewhere that wasn't a concern, I'm thinking like bricks of peanut brittle or some other like caramelized sugar.
Actually think that's a really good one. If you like, you think of peanut brittle as like a flat thing because we bake it, but if you were to make a brick of peanut brittle,
yeah,
that would be really hard to break down.
I think it could support a lot of weight, right? Like I am no,
it's not the answer that Kyle and I were discussing.
You have your own ideas.
I actually think, Julian, you may have said one of the best answers, and I don't think you realized
it. Oh, yeah?
Salt.
Salt.
Cut it into bricks.
I mean, until it rains.
Guys, I think Julian hit on something so close that made me realize I think I know what the answer to this question
is. Oh, yeah?
Can you read the question again? The specific question, Kyle, please.
What is the best food to make a house out of?
How do we define food?
Oh, you technicality loving. Are we defining it as human food?
A substance that people or animals eat or drink that plants absorb in order to maintain life and growth. The answer to this is snow.
Oh, okay.
It's a construction material that people use all the time. It holds up to the weather in the area that you can use it to build in. You can eat all of it.
Okay. I honestly was, I was working my way in the direction of frozen foods.
Yes!
I was going to eventually land on some like frozen hot pocket out in the Canadian tundra. So, like, if you want bricks, because I'm thinking he's thinking, oh, burrito like a brick would be terrible, right? Like, but yeah, let's cut out the middleman. Although, what if we pour some snow cone sugar and dye on our igloo, right? Mm. And you're technically therefore like, look, it's food. It really is food, but it's way too cold for anything to actually like start eating it because everything's frozen.
Yeah.
It's structurally sound. Yeah. Technically, you could eat it in a pinch.
I feel like peanut brittle is also an excellent answer because it's just like, I can't imagine. Remember the episode we did where the woman invented the thing where it like crushes different foods to determine?
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the device now. It was a funny
it
name.
It was a
like
weird
the crunchulator.
One. Yeah.
But I would want to know how much weight brick of peanut brittle can hold, but who makes peanut brittle in bricks? Like, nobody. It's hard to chew it,
yeah.
And the best of times when it's like half a centimeter thick, let alone a brick.
Could you make it in a brick, right? If it's important that it's in like that thin layer, so everything, I don't know, I've never made it. So
I'm sure you could.
I couldn't tell you.
I've made it. It's basically caramel. I mean, it's just caramel
so you've
with
just
peanuts,
melted.
Right? And so you could make it as a brick. I don't know if it would harden without like a industrial sized kiln, but if you were trying to like, if you were needed to, you know, this was cloudy with a chance of peanut brittle and you were trying to make the food products into things, yeah, I think it's a great answer.
But honestly, I think you kind of saved me there with snow cone some kind. Kyle's idea of salt is fascinating right up until it rains and then all those bonds dissolve. Oh, boy. Okay, I'm just glad that my time is done. And with a softball, thank you for the assist.
Kyle.
Yeah, Kyle.
Please, Kyle. Kyle, be kind.
Kyle, what's Trace's last question?
What's my question, Kyle?
Trace.
Yeah.
Susan says.
Susan.
Prove you exist.
God, Kyle.
Susan continues. Go on, prove it.
Susan! Kyle!
No! No! I can't close on this much existential dread.
Oh, God.
No! All right, Kyle, set the timer. 5 minutes.
Thanks, man. Okay, here I go. Headphones off. Bye.
Oh, my gosh.
I was thinking about the, how do you tell an alien
left?
Which way is left? And this is so much worse.
So much worse. It's really more a philosophical question.
I hate this.
I love him chiming in occasionally. That's hilarious.
I'm racking my brain. I don't even know where I'd start.
I'm thinking about like the Turing test and all of these like existential external metrics that we use to judge sentience and like. All of that stuff is subjective.
Right, and you know, not only that, but again, you're talking about sentience, but like a computer exists. If the computer fails the Turing test, it still exists, right? Or
true.
We agree that it does, but how do we prove?
I'm just sitting here. I can't hear you, but I'm just sitting here staring at the screen thinking.
One way that I would prove that I exist is to step on a scale, to go outside and show you my shadow.
Here's where my mind goes after that. I don't know if I can prove that I exist to you, because I don't know if I can prove that you exist to me. Like, could you be a hallucination totally imagined? Absolutely. All of it could be.
That's an interesting response to Susan.
Yeah.
Prove it to who?
Yeah.
To you?
How do I prove that even you exist? How do I prove.
Do I have any gravitational pull?
Yes, you do. You have mass.
That's an objective way to measure it,
I suppose. Yeah, I mean, we have to take some. We have to make some certain assumptions, right? Like that the people we're proving it to are real. That the laws of physics that we've learned are all, you know, that we're not in like a simulation, you know, like.
And if we were in a simulation, the rules of physics would be very convenient. You know, think about Kerbal Space Program, and they've essentially replicated physics in a piece of software.
I did a long time ago. I worked for a channel that we were trying to start called Play Noggin, where we took video games and tried to explain scientific concepts. And like, I tried to tackle the "Are we in a simulation?" kind of thought experiment with Minecraft, and I was like, "Look, in Minecraft, use the rules of the established world to make a functioning computer that makes a simulacrum yeah. of Minecraft, right? So like, wow. You're just burning processing power, you know, at every level that you go down, right? Because like, it's getting yeah. less and less efficient. But like, so long as the world has established rules, right? Like a lot of games just fake the physics, you know? It just says yeah. like, oh, if you, and so there's ways to break it. Like old games before they had physics engines, it's like, okay, yeah, like you could drop stuff, but then if you walked off the map where there's no floor anymore, you don't fall forever. You're just like floating because there's nothing down, really. I don't know, stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
I also imagine somebody using this argument to get out of like a speeding ticket. Like, officer, you can't prove I was speeding because you cannot prove my existence. Your time is up, if you even have time to
oh
begin
my
with.
God.
If time exists.
What is
at all.
Time? I don't even know.
Did you have fun with this? Because I had no idea where to start, and I was really glad it wasn't my question.
I think you do? An answer. I think I actually have an answer. Like, I think I have a good answer. I'm excited about this. Okay, let me just smack my face a little bit. Here we go. Okay, so the philosophers Chalmers and Searle have said that you cannot have objectivity. And just as a reminder, the question is, prove you exist with additional information of go on, prove it. Thank you, Susan. According to these philosophers, everything is subjective, right? However, then scientists come along and they start to create what we think of as objective reality, this like Newtonian physics. And you start to build this reality of like, oh, we can observe these things. They are real. We can feel them. We can see their effects, right? You know, particles have mass, charge, and other intrinsic properties. No matter how you measure them, they are there. However, over time, and I started Googling things and found, you know, research about philosophy and proving you exist is very complicated. And it's very cool right now to use, I was going to say gauche. It's very gauche right now to use that we have no free will and that there's and it actually doesn't mean what I thought it meant, but it's sort of, I meant it as a derisive way of saying cute. Like, it's very cute to be like, well, there's no objectivity and everything is subjective and there's no free will. And it's just part of this sort of dystopian feeling that a lot of people have in a post-pandemic adjustment place. And I get that. It's I feel it, too. And there are things that happen when we are not there that we see the results of. And so thus, there is objectivity in the neurotransmissions. Another YouTube channel commented on a Reddit thread about almost this exact topic. And I like them a lot. They said, one way to look at it is that there isn't any objectivity. But the real question is, if humans or any living thing are incapable of objectivity, then is objectivity real? Does it only exist in a theoretical landscape? Is it possible there's no such thing as objectivity? And so then I started thinking about it as like, okay, well, relativity showed that, and quantum mechanics showed the observer is the reality. You observe a particle and it changes when you observe it, and no one else can observe it the way that you observed it. I feel like I'm rambling, but the idea here is to prove that I exist. And so if a particle changes upon my observation, did I not change it?
I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know. I honestly don't know.
That's like the basis of the Schrodinger cat thought experiment, though, right? Because Schrodinger was like, why would you change it? That's ridiculous.
I think there's some level of this of like proving you exist is like silly one. But there's some like the Truman Show delusion. Do you remember this? A guy named Nicholas Marzano sued HBO in 2015. He said, this is a real thing. He alleged in his case that HBO had hidden cameras throughout his home, installed controlling devices in his car, enlisted the help of local police, recruited actors to portray attorneys, law enforcement officials, physicians, government employees, prospective employers, families, friends, neighbors, and coworkers. That's a quote. Also that their show about Mr. Marzano could happen. And he sued HBO for doing this to him. It turned out he had active phase psychosis, and he no longer believes this because he has gotten help, which is great. But this question is sort of being like, prove that I'm on a television show. And it's like, no one around you is going to tell you you're on a television show because they're on the show too, right? So you can't prove it.
Yeah.
However, I think I have an answer to being able to prove that I exist.
Okay.
There's a thing called the Boltzmann brain problem. Have you heard of this?
No.
Katie Mack, Dr. Katie Mack, was on my channel over the pandemic, and we talked about time and what time is, where it comes from. And she says there's this problem called the Boltzmann brain problem. It has to do a little bit with Occam's razor, in which, if you don't know, is like the simplest explanation is often the best, I think is the simplest way to describe the Occam's razor. So if you say the Big Bang happened, right? The universe comes into existence and all this stuff is happening. So if we came out of some random fluctuations between the Big Bang and heat death of the universe, is it more likely that that random fluctuation created a whole complex universe with galaxy formation and a variety of different aliens and cultures and experiences? Or, I'm just watching Julian's face, is it more likely that all of that created a single brain floating in emptiness that is imagining all of that happening?
The first one, the former.
Oh my God.
Glad we solved that.
So that's the Boltzmann brain problem, is this idea that all of the universe is really just the giant celestial brain from the second Guardians of the Galaxy. Right? It's just floating in the universe, imagining everything around it is actually happening. The thing is, that brain exists, and maybe I'm that brain.
Wait. Are you saying simultaneously you are the center of the universe, you're the only thing in the universe, and you're Kurt Russell from Guardians of the Galaxy Part 2?
Maybe slightly handsomer, but sure.
I'm so confused.
Okay, well, I'll go with a simpler one then. I get junk mail, so I must exist. Why would they send it to me otherwise?
It's true. You show up. Liz, when you need to prove that you live in a state, you show up with your mail and you're like, look, here's my, I'm paying a utility bill here.
I get you want to sell me your internet packages and your credit cards and your coupons.
I want to go back to the Boltzmann brain thing. I don't know where to start. Seriously, are you saying there's two possibilities? Either some, you know, mind pewter that can imagine everything formed from the just how the universe came together and this is all a hallucination. Or the universe actually does exist. But either way, you're that mind pewter and therefore
no
slash part of the universe. So it doesn't matter.
Firstly,
what?
Firstly, Ludwig Boltzmann's the one who's actually saying the Boltzmann brain is possible, but or is like a philosophical idea. I'm just saying, if there is a Boltzmann brain and we are a product of that thing, which we can't disprove that Boltzmann brain exists. So wouldn't I, by even like the imagining of the Boltzmann brain is the Boltzmann brain's proof of its existence. If it didn't exist, it wouldn't be imagining everything that's happening. So maybe I'm not the Boltzmann's brain. We're just products of it.
But you are some like synaptic firing within the Boltzmann brain.
Which means the Boltzmann brain exists.
But even if you're a product of synapses firing, would you say then that like the synapse firing is you and therefore in some way you exist? You know?
Yeah.
Like I'm thinking of it this way. If a person has hallucinations and they hear voices, right? Like those voices don't belong to a person, but they exist in the form of signals in their brain.
Right.
If
we're really
tetchy about the definition of existing.
Sure. Why not? Do you think rainbows exist?
Yeah, right. It's a it's perception.
And when I want people to stop talking about whatever inane things they're talking about and talk about the inane thing that I want to talk about, I usually just say like, well, rainbows don't even exist.
Inane bows.
And they're like, what are you talking about? I've seen so many rainbows. And I'm like, yeah, but you wouldn't have seen it if you were 100 feet to your left or right, maybe, or like a mile to your left. That rainbow's not there because it only exists.
You just happen to be where that light converged in your eyeball and made you think there was a rainbow in the distance.
And then they fight about it, and it's fun.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. You exist, but rainbows don't. Rainbows are a lie.
You heard it here first. You are just the musings of a giant space brain. And or you might objectively exist because you're vibrating a bunch of strings in what we perceive to be the universe, and you can perceive that you perceived those strings.
Well, Susan, I'm glad
it doesn't matter. Susan doesn't exist anyway.
Well, that was phenomenal, Trace. Thank you so much.
Sorry about that. Kyle, thank you for picking those questions.
Absolutely. That was so much fun.
This was a great lightning round. It was so stressful. I need a shower.
I'm going to be looking into the answers of all of these for like the rest of the day just to like double, triple check, you know?
I didn't expect you guys to get so stressed about them. And now I sort of see inside your world.
We care.
You do. And this was fun for me, not so much for you. I loved it.
I'm so glad. Well, I'm so glad. Yeah, Kyle, thanks for joining us. Thanks for being a part of, you know, the show for the last year. We're so glad that we could actually have you on so people could like hear you and like get to appreciate everything that you do. And thank you for being our MC for the lightning round.
Well, thank you for having me.
Hopefully they appreciate you as much as we appreciate you. Now that you have tortured us publicly in front of them.
It's not public yet. We can still bury this thing.
You're going to make yourself look so... You're going to give yourself, like, the best filters. You'll be like, hey, I'm Kyle.
The Morgan Freeman voice changer.
Well, with that, I think we should wrap up this extra long episode of That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. But before we do, I really want to thank all of you out there for listening to the show for the last year. We do this just for fun. We do this because we like each other. We like learning new things and obviously talking about them. You could tell, hopefully, from this episode that this is really just something we love. And to have other people out there in the world love it, too, is very meaningful. So thank you for listening to this. For a whole year, we've been able to make this. And now that we're weekly, holy wow, we're going to make a lot more of it. So I really hope you continue to tell your friends about the show, give us reviews and ratings, and tell us how you feel, and make sure you send in those questions, because now we need 52 of them every year in order to keep the show going. So
we need 104 because we do two a week.
Oh no. See, this is, I told you, math. It's not my thing. Just thanks, Julian. You're listening to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. And this show was created, written, and produced by all three of us. Julian Huguet, Kyle Sisk, and me, Trace, that other guy.
Special thanks to the listeners who submitted questions featured in this episode: Sean, JW, Edward, Ben, Mark, and Susan. If you'd like to submit, look for the form in the show notes, or you could email us at hello@thatsabsurdshow.com. If you go to that website, you can also ask us a question there. thatsabsurdshow.com/ask. And once again, keep them rolling in. They make us laugh, and they make the show possible.
Like we always say, if you're going to build a house out of food, use potato bricks.
Like my dad always told me.
Like my dad always said, son,
you exist because I say you exist.
My brain floating in soup brought you into this world, and I can imagine you out.